Evening's Prom. It's presented by Andrew McGregor.
It's going to be an Anglo-French evening here in the hall. The Brits get the first half to themselves, while the French occupy the second half of the concert and commandeer the epic organ of the Royal Albert Hall as well. When organist Thomas Trotter joins the BBC National Orchestra of Wales for Marcel Dupré's Cortège and Litany, and then the great organ symphony by Saint-Saëns that Dupré himself played here at the Proms 76 years ago. François-Xavier Rout is the orchestra's associate guest conductor. I know he's really been looking forward to this prom.
It is the best festival ever. It's the only place where you have such an audience. And also the Hollywood spirit is still here in terms of, well, for example, the program that we present tonight is really a festival program. It's not a program that you could find in a regular symphonic season, but it's something so unique. So for all these reasons, it's such a joy to be here.
He really means it. So what about our two British composers in the first half of the prom? The shadow of war hangs over two of the works. Simon Holt's Centauromachy is a concerto for clarinet and flugelhorn that depicts a battle between fantastic creatures from Greek mythology, while Frank Bridges' Blow Out You Bugles is a pacifist composer's reflection on the First World War. But the work we're going to hear first was written 9 years later, in 1927. It's Bridges' orchestral rhapsody, Enter Spring, which has the pastoral qualities you might expect, knowing that Bridges' inspiration was the windswept Sussex Downs in which he had his country cottage. Yet the accent might seem more French than English pastoral. Bridge was a fan of Gabriel Fauré, and he shows himself to be out of step with European modernism and more in tune with the landscapes of late Debussy or Ravel. Well, the BBC National Orchestra of Wales is led by Leslie Hatfield. She's already in her seat at the front of the first violins. And here to welcome the season of rebirth and renewal comes François-Xavier Rout to conduct Frank Bridges' Enter Spring.
Thank you. We'll be right back.
birdsong and bells and an exuberant welcome to the new season arriving in all its glory. Enter Spring, the orchestral rhapsody by Frank Bridge, played by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by François-Xavier Roth. A 13-year-old schoolboy called Benjamin Britten was at the first performance in 1927. He signed up as a pupil of Frank Bridge soon afterwards. And if Enter Spring seems to have been forgotten after the early 1930s, it wasn't by Britten who made sure Spring re-entered at the 1967 Aldborough Festival, 40 years after its premiere. Well, as a lifelong pacifist, Frank Bridge was deeply shaken by the First World War and the loss of so many friends and pupils. It's easy to understand his attraction to Rupert Brooke's best-known sonnet from 1914, Blow Out, You Bugles, with its meditation on the loss of so many young lives in battle, especially since it was commissioned by the wife of tenor Gervase Elwes. Their four sons were on active service. Elwes gave the first performance in the Queen's Hall in London in 1918, with Bridge conducting just 2 weeks before the armistice. And I asked this evening's soloist, Ben Johnson, what makes Bridge's vocal setting so special?
I find his music just not quite as it seems, and I find that very intelligent, engaging. And I also think, reading about him, that he'd be a very, very interesting man to meet. I sort of wish he was still a professor at the college when I was there, because I think there's something very, very clever and special bubbling under the surface, the way he offsets parts of the orchestra that to our ears mean pomp and circumstance and tragedy of death in the war against each other. And it's split into sections where oboes take over from trumpets in the most drastic way, which is actually rather shocking when we throw away the pomp and circumstance and find that we're talking about people who have died.
Tenor Ben Johnson, a BBC New Generation artist and soloist, in the performance we're about to hear of Blow Out, You Bugles by Frank Bridge. And if you'd like to see the text for yourself, then look at the programme notes for this evening's concert online on the BBC Proms website. And that applause is for Ben Johnson and conductor François-Xavier Roth, who are about to perform Blow Out, You Bugles by Frank Bridge.
The red sweet wine of youth,
First World War poets Rupert Brooke reflecting on the honour of the noble dead in Blow Out, You Bugles, the sonnet set to music by Frank Bridge, first performed just before the end of the war in the old Proms venue, the Queen's Hall, and here in the Proms' second home, we've just heard it performed by tenor Ben Jonson with the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by François-Xavier Roth. And if after hearing these two works by Bridge in this evening's Prom, you're thinking of finding yourself a more permanent souvenir, then I can certainly recommend the Bridge recordings the BBC National Orchestra of Wales made with Richard Hickox. You'll find both Enter Spring and Blow Out, You Bugles amongst them. And Ben Jonson's back on stage on his own this time, bowing low to the promenaders and applauding the orchestra behind him. The young man in demand at the moment, he's off to the Three Choirs Festival tomorrow to sing Elgar's Caractacus with Sir Andrew Davis, and he has his English National Opera debut in September. Well, the next work we're going to hear is less than a year old and depicts a mythological battle. It's Centauromachy by Simon Holt, composer in association with the BBC National Orchestra of Wales. A concerto in which the centaur, half-man, half-horse, is depicted by two soloists from the orchestra, clarinetist Robert Plain and trumpeter Philippe Schatz playing the flugelhorn. The composer himself can talk us through Centauromachy's five movements.
Two Natures is the first movement, which is really just a duet. So we have the flugelhorn and the clarinet enmeshed, intertwined around one another. The second movement is a sort of dream sequence, where we sort of get to know them a bit better and they take that material on into a sort of fantastical world. And the middle movement is really about the idea of seeing the magical creature, but separated, as it were, split apart in a forest. The trees are the orchestra, and the two soloists are completely independent of each other and the orchestra. The fourth movement is the pitched battle between the centaurs and the lapiths, which is one of the great scenes in mythology. Then the final movement is a very slow, slightly ethereal elegy for Chiron, the greatest of all the centaurs.
Why these instruments, and was it always for these players?
These are two of the star players in the orchestra, and I thought it would be nice to put them together and do a double concerto, because I've got quite a few solo concertos now. And I thought, why not two? And why not clarinet? And it was going to be trumpet. Then I thought, actually, no, let's try flugelhorn, because I think I'd just written for the flugelhorn in a piece called Sueños, and I really liked the sound. And then the idea of the centaurs came with that, the idea of two natures in one.
Simon Holt and the mythological battle he mentioned that gives its name to Centauromachy refers to an incident at a wedding feast to which the Lapith tribe invited their cousins, the centaurs, who turned out not to be used to drinking wine and attempted to ravish the bride and the wedding guests, leading to the pitched battle we hear in the fourth movement. And here are our soloists, Robert Plain and Philippe Schatz, with conductor François-Xavier Roth to conduct Centauromachy by Simon Holt.
Thank you. Thank you.
An elegy for Chiron, the wisest and kindest of centaurs, who sacrificed his life in exchange for Prometheus so that mankind could have the use of fire. That's the last part of Centauromachy by Simon Holt, written for the performers you've just heard. Clarinetist Robert Plain and Philippe Schatz on flugelhorn, both of them section principals with the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by François Xavier Roth. And here's the composer, Simon Holt, applauded and embraced warmly by the conductor, shaking hands and hugging the soloists in turn as well, and now applauding the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, who gave the first performance with the same forces in Cardiff last November. And Simon was telling me that a few things have changed in the score since that first performance. Not many. He said even a harp note during this afternoon's rehearsal. And he says it's great having the orchestra play it again 9 months later, when it's no longer a new piece to them. And if you look at the Proms archive online, you'll find that no fewer than 11 works by Simon Holt have been heard at the Proms before. This orchestra premiered Troubled Light 3 years ago, launching Simon's position with them as composer in association. Here they come again, Simon Holt leading on Robert Plain and Philippe Schatz and François Xavier Roth. The four of them bowing low as the orchestra stands and acknowledges the warmth of the reception for that recently written work, Centauromachy. Well, since that piece, Troubled Light, Simon's written a short piece for the opening of the new home of the orchestra at the Wales Millennium Centre. And next year, soprano Lisa Milne sings a new Holt commission with them in Cardiff, Yellow Wallpaper. That's next April the 20th. If you want to put it in your diary. Well, that's the British first half of this evening's Anglo-French prom. It's this season's prom's theme of French connections that takes over after the interval and breathes life into the far-from-mythical beast slumbering behind the stage, the enormous organ of the Royal Albert Hall. Thomas Trotter will be the soloist in works by two fine French composers, the Cortège and Litany by Marcel Dupré and the Organ Symphony by Camille Saint-Saëns. I'm already grinning from ear to ear, remembering the sound from this afternoon's rehearsal. You have to hear it for yourself. Now, I suspect we've all been listening pretty attentively to the music in this evening's prom so far, but how much attention do we normally pay to our sonic environment, the everyday sounds that surround us? We're about to meet Sebastian Hegarty, an artist who works in a variety of media, and much of his recent work has been exploring the soundscapes of southern England.
As a visual artist working with sound, I am drawn to the spatial and temporal qualities that sound affords. I'm interested in how sound and listening place us in the world. Recording has become a habit, a method of engaging with the people and environment around me. I use an array of contact microphones, hydrophones, and other microphone technologies, along with different recording methods, to help me listen in on the sounding environment. This is the car park at Hengistbury Head in Dorset. I had been asked to record the song of the skylarks, but when I arrived, I was greeted by the delicious radiophonic static of starlings. I tuned myself in. Each soundscape has a certain disposition, a particular relationship with time and place. Here, the starlings signaled my arrival within a spectral landscape, a place between stations, continually ebbing in and out of existence. Behind the head of Hengistbury, there's an area of quiet. I noticed a wire fence and attached a contact microphone. There emerged an ethereal and harmonic hum as the sea breeze brushed through the wires. I am drawn to the sonic details and inconspicuous miniatures which listening seeks out. In order to focus my attention on these miniatures, I often close my eyes and mimic disappearance. As if not seeing allows the borders between my listening and the soundscape to be dissolved. From the distance, my microphone reels in the approaching snort of a dog holding its head in a stick above water. It closes in, emerging from the sea with a damp canine wallop of sound. My walking, like my listening, has a tendency to wander. I saunter, meander, and go astray in a seemingly aimless transit. This wayfaring draws out a line of listening and recording that develops freely and in its own time. The wayfarer happens upon, discovering the unsought through the unintentional. When I set out to record a specific sound, I stop listening. I become frustrated and disappointed with what is available to hear. Listening lets sounds be, shifting attention to the moment and uncovering the unfamiliar within the familiar, the hidden within the given. This is the meditative two-stroke pulse of the land train humming itself into view. Normally, when people see the microphone, they shy away, whisper sorry, or even perform a sort of pantomimic tiptoe. Children don't. They prefer to say hello. Obviously, goodbye would have been more appropriate. Listening to the waves from beneath the beach, the hydrophone sounds like a Geiger counter, calculating the individual sonic particles of sound. On the seafront, I could see a silent, empty flagpole, visibly trembling in the wind. I know that vibration makes sound, so I attached a contact microphone, but heard nothing. Then suddenly, a certain frequency of tremor was reached, and a wingnut at the top of the pole began to peel, sounding out this clangorous alarm. It felt like I could hear the sirens of the Isle of Wight, wanting me to run aground on the needles. In 2010, working with Hampshire Wildlife Trust in Winchester, I began work on the Whinnell-Moores Soundwalk. The aim is to create a soundwalk based on recordings made within the reserve over the period of a year. This would allow the acoustic patterns of the soundscape to become apparent. It was the academic and composer Amaury Schaefer who defined soundscape as a sonic environment, a sonic identity, a sonic memory, at least sound pertinent to place. John Cage had already opened the doors of music to the sounds which happened to be in the environment. For Cage, the whole world is a score, and when we walk through it, we organise its sound. Listening becomes a compositional act. My practice explores how listening can reveal unfamiliar aspects of what is already there, and how the subsequent slicing, shifting, and pleating of recorded sound can create other places, relocating the listener and perhaps heightening perception of the soundscape surrounding us. The Moors Soundwalk begins at dawn on Christmas Day. The crackle of ice precedes my steps on the boardwalk as I walk back into the morning of the summer solstice. superimposed with the ringing of birds, captured in nets, invisible then and inaudible now. The dawn chorus is full of DNA melodies and the acoustic territories of birds. Although some research suggests that the chorus is actually just birds passing time until the food wakes up, a sort of bored whistling. During the ringing process, the birds hang in cotton bags suspended from metal poles. The sound of feathers attempting flight within the confines of the bags is scarily claustrophobic. It feels like we're spitting feathers, or rather, swallowing them. My listening is not confined to the wildlife of the moors. The complete and complex nature of the soundscape has my attention. The weather, the acoustic surroundings, even the resonant metallic interruption of a fence across a closed bridge adds its own spatial and textural qualities. The fence makes the feet of children into giants. Listening to sounds without sight of their origin seems to offer an escape of the senses. Sound spills into taste and touch through a synesthetic palette of sonic surfaces and textures. The river water sounds cold and clear. I can see through it, and it makes me thirsty. The scientific observation and measurement of the reserve introduce their own sounds and patterns. This is the monthly kick sample in which Dr. Ben Rushbrook walks up the river, rolling over the riverbed to disturb and capture the fly larvae. The diversity and quantity of this indicate the ecological health of the moors. Moors Reserve requires maintenance and repair, and this work introduces its own physical voice. The sinking of a fence post into the ground has its own rhythms, conversations, and narratives. The electrical clairvoyance of hydrophones and contact microphones allows the discrete sounds hiding beneath the soundscape to be summoned to the surface. I can hear the sound of rain falling on barbed wire, the subaquatic gaseous songs of pondweed, the territorial rhythmic patterns of a water boatman. The short walk ends under a pagoda on the 50th anniversary of the Wildlife Trust, listening to the dissonant aeolian shade of the pagoda's metal frame as it creaks in the breeze. My investigation of soundscape is not confined to the natural landscape. The built environment is just as fascinating. The bells of Winchester Cathedral peal out time over the moors. Schaefer described the church bell as a centripetal sound, enclosing the listener and calling them in. My listening followed the bells back to their architectural epicentre. The cathedral could be seen as a piece of acoustic architecture, a place designed to move sound around, raising the voice and thought of praise and prayer towards the heavens. I arrived early to hear a canticle of keys opening up the cathedral for me. The cathedral has its own time and acoustic calendars. Bells announce marriage and prayer. Matins opens the religious day. The organist arrives to practice, and the caretakers prepare the elevated seating for the choristers. Space is suspended in an anticipation of time to come. The rehearsal of sound, the practice and recital of organ and prayer, everything is waiting to be heard. The echoing passage of someone's steps arriving for communion describe and are themselves described by the architecture of the building. In counterpoint to their sweet and angelic air, the rather garrulous feet of the choristers descend from the elevated seating in an almost demonic canter. Unbeknown to me, a performance of Haydn's Creation was being performed in the evening. The kettle drums sound, not through being struck, but being wheeled into place. The musician's rehearsal provides all the right notes, but not necessarily in the right order. The practice of scales adds a further ascent, and I rather bravely decide to follow them up to the roof of the cathedral. The voices of the choir hang around the ceiling as I ascend. In the soundscape of the belfry, there appears the quiet, mechanistic click of the cathedral clock. Listening to time tick away is quite absorbing, even meditative. I found myself implicated in a kind of sonic vigil, listening and waiting for the next second to arrive and disappear. And my pilgrim ears complete their return to the toll of the bell. The cathedral soundscape conjures up a form of pictorial space. We imagine the thing that made each sound. Other soundscapes provide an abstracted landscape where the notion of fixed and pictorial space may disappear completely. On a beach in Norfolk, a rather awkward wire fence visually partitioned the land from the ocean. In order to hear what I could see, I attached my contact microphone to the fence and was immediately engulfed in a delicate but vast harmonic hum. I felt isolated and strangely transparent as I listened to a voice that no one else could hear. Acoustic space remains undefined and emergent, a region without permanent borders. Sound diffuses certainty and laps away at the established edges of visual space. Seeing confirms, but listening prefers to question.
The sound of a wire fence recorded by Sebastian Hegarty, who was talking about his work with soundscapes. And the programme was produced in Bristol by Chris Ledyard. The soundscapes in which we're about to be immersed are pretty expansive, as in the second half of this evening's prom here on BBC Radio 3, the great Father Willis Organ of the Royal Albert Hall joins forces with the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and conductor François-Xavier Rutt. And together, they can make a spectacular sound. Welcome back. I'm Andrew McGregor, and the main work in the second half is the Symphony No. 3 by Camille Saint-Saëns, his organ symphony with its unforgettably thunderous climax. Franz Liszt, no mean organist himself, remember, calls Saint-Saëns the greatest organist in the world, a phenomenal improviser and virtuoso. Henry Wood himself conducted the organ symphony at the Proms in 1935 for the Saint-Saëns centenary concert, and the soloist on that occasion was Marcel Dupré, longtime organist of the Church of Saint-Sulpice in Paris, the cathedral of the left bank. Dupré was already a Proms regular, performing almost every season in the 1930s. And speaking to the BBC in 1969, he had fond memories of his first meeting with Henry Wood.
It was in 1925 that I made the acquaintance of Sir Henry Wood in London. He came to me after a recital I have been giving at Queen's Hall, and his simplicity, his cordiality, immediately won my heart. The rehearsal has been thrilling with such a conductor as Sir Henry, who was always one with the orchestra and the soloist. Then came the concert, as early as 5 o'clock from our windows at the Langham Hotel across the street. We were amazed, my wife and me, to see the queue growing. 2 hours later, when I appeared in the hall, I was most impressed by the sight of the enormous crowd standing shoulder to shoulder in the pit and who was to remain thus until the end of the concert. And when Sir Henry Radiant appeared with a big carnation at his buttonhole, he was greeted with such a storm of applause as I have seldom heard.
Isn't that a wonderful piece of archive? Organist Marcel Dupré reminiscing about his Proms experiences in 1969 for Sir Henry Wood's centenary year. And before we hear the Saint-Saëns organ symphony, we'll hear a rare gem for organ and orchestra, Dupré's Cortège and Litany, which dates from the early 20s. I asked this evening's soloist, Thomas Trotter, what the piece tells us about Dupré's gifts as an organist.
He was a master craftsman. He knew exactly how to write for the organ, and he knew exactly what stops he wanted you to use, because the registration is quite detailed. And he wrote very well for those sounds. He wrote very idiomatically for those particular registers that he asked for.
And does it feel as though this was one of those works that began as an improvisation? Does it have that character about it?
I don't think so. I mean, this piece is very carefully worked out. It begins with a chorale theme, which is shared between the strings and then the organ. And then the litany is a flowing semi-quaver theme, which is passed between the instruments of the orchestra, the flute, and then the clarinet, and then you hear it on the strings. And then finally, the whole orchestra take up the litany theme, and the organ comes crashing in with the chorale theme of the opening. To me, it doesn't sound like an improvisation at all.
Thomas Trotter, tonight's organ soloist. And here he comes, making his way along to the console of the Royal Albert Hall organ, standing just behind the bust of Sir Henry Wood. And François Xavier Roth bows to the promise in front of him. We're going to hear Cortège and Litany by Marcel Dupré. Cortege and Litany by Marcel Dupré, performed by Thomas Trotter at the Organ of the Royal Albert Hall with the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by François-Xavier Roth. That apparently began life in 1922 as a piano piece, but Dupré turned it into a display work for the world's largest playable pipe organ in Wanamaker's department store in Philadelphia, where Dupré joined forces with the Philadelphia Orchestra and Leopold Stokowski for the first performance in 1925. Well, 71 years ago, Dupré played the Saint-Saëns Organ Symphony at the Proms with Sir Henry Wood, just a year after he'd been made organist of Saint-Sulpice in Paris, succeeding his teacher, Vidor. Dupré was there until his death in 1971, and since the mid-80s, the post has belonged to French organist Daniel Roth, who just happens to be conductor François Xavier's father. In fact, they made a live recording of the Saint-Saëns in Saint-Sulpice together. So I asked François Xavier just how Saint-Saëns uses the sound of the organ with the orchestra.
It's a symphony which is very new for many aspects, and the first one is really the structure of the piece. You don't hear the organ all the time. You have only, it starts like a regular symphony, I would say, with only the orchestra, and then joins at the beginning of the slow movement the magic sounds of the organ. And then the organ doesn't play for the scherzo and comes back at the end. And more than a combination with this huge instrument, I think it's a piece that Saint-Saëns, at this time, he really succeeds something special.
And here he comes again, François Xavier Roth, to conduct Saint-Saëns C minor organ symphony in four movements.
Thank you.
Well, you don't need me to tell you how that felt in the hall. The triumphant conclusion to the Symphony No. 3 by Camille Saint-Saëns, his organ symphony. I should emphasise the word feel, actually, when the great organ of the Royal Albert Hall unleashes that mighty roar, the vibrations are felt throughout the building, and if you're promming, it travels through your body from the soles of your feet. The organist was Thomas Trotter, and the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, led by Leslie Hatfield, was conducted by François-Xavier Roth. Here he comes back onto the platform, just staying at the back and waving for Thomas Trotter to get to his feet and take a bow behind the bust of Sir Henry Wood in front of the magnificent Father Willis organ here in the hall. And now back to the front of the stage, the BBC National Orchestra of Wales standing across Sir Xavier, bowing low to the audience. And Thomas Trotter recorded a CD on the instrument, which was released earlier this year, his Grand Organ Prom, he called it, and it included a number of works by the great W.T. Best, the supreme British concert organist of the Victorian era, who was actually given the position of organist at the Royal Albert Hall in 1871 and gave the inaugural recital on the new Willis instrument. Thomas Trotter, I guess, has some idea of what that felt like. He was one of the three organists who reopened the newly restored Albert Hall organ back in 2004. Well, the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, I suppose you could call them Doctor Who's house band after all the work they've done for the TV series soundtrack. They're going on their summer break tonight. They'll be back here on the 3rd of September with another organist, David Good, and an organ concerto this time by Michael Barclay. Marc-André Amelin's the pianist for Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini, and Jacques Van Steen conducts Kodály's Harry Janosch. That's the prom on the 3rd of September, live here on BBC Radio 3, of course. Well, Thomas Trotter's still sitting in front of the organ, beaming from ear to ear. I'll be back for tomorrow evening's second prom, the late one, with American minimalist Steve Reich and Ensemble Moderne. That's at 10:15 tomorrow night, and what a contrast it's going to be to the enormous climax of this evening's Anglo-French extravaganza. So with Saint-Saëns' thunderous C major still ringing in our ears and the fabric of the building shaken to its foundations, I'll hand you back to the still calm ambience of Broadcasting House. Here's John Shea.
Andrew McGregor, thank you very much. That was Andrew presenting tonight's live prom from the Royal Albert Hall, and you'll be able to hear the concert again on Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. If you're not free to listen to it on Sunday afternoon, of course, there's another way for you to catch up with this or any of our proms, and that's online. Go to the Radio 3 website and follow the Listen Again links where every concert is available for 7 days. Well, Andrew just mentioned tomorrow night's second prom, the late prom with music by Steve Reich at 10:15 tomorrow night. Before that, the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra will be in action at 7 o'clock tomorrow evening. Kirill Karabets conducts them in three colourful scores. Liszt's Mazeppa, Glier's Concerto for Coloratura Soprano, in which the Irish soprano Eilish Tynan is the soloist. And after the interval, Rachmaninoff's Second Symphony. So that's tomorrow evening's first prom, live from the Royal Albert Hall at 7 o'clock.
The BBC Proms, a festival of extraordinary musical experiences. Friday night is film music night at the BBC Proms. I'm Katie Derham. Join me on BBC Radio 3 as the music of John Williams, Bernard Herrmann and John Barry comes to the 2011 BBC Proms season. Years of film music from Hitchcock and Herrmann to Harry Potter. Friday night at the BBC Proms from 7 o'clock.
And just before we leave the subject of the proms for this evening, I should tell you that tomorrow afternoon from 2, you've another chance to hear last Saturday's prom given by the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain, Vladimir Yurovsky conducting, a programme that included Benjamin Grosvenor playing Britten's piano concerto and DJ Switch in Gabriel Prokofiev's Concerto for Turntables and Orchestra. Last Saturday night's concert on the air again here on Radio 3 tomorrow afternoon from 2. Well, our next scheduled programme this evening on Radio 3 is our feature at 9:15. Harriet Gilbert will be looking at the life and work of the celebrated and sometimes controversial Palestinian poet, the late Mahmoud Darwish. That's at 9:15. Well, as you may know, Anton Ariensky is our current Composer of the Week here on BBC Radio 3. Donald MacLeod continues his survey of the Russian composer's music tomorrow at 12 noon, or again at 6 o'clock in the evening. And to take us up to 9:15 this evening and our feature, here's some piano music by one of Ariensky's contemporaries, Alexander Glazunov. Two pieces, Opus 22 by Alexander Glazunov, a barcarolle and a novelette, and Stephen Coombs was the pianist.
The question is not what you look at, but what you see.
The camera was no longer an instrument that recorded presences. It was a way of making the world disappear.
I know I change, have changed, but whose is this vapid face, suspended in empty paper, as though in a telescope?
From Auden Atwood and Oster to Leos Janacek and Charles Ives. On BBC Radio 3, music, poetry and prose inspired by centuries of photographs and photography, with Robert Powell and Geraldine James. The Photograph.
On the screen, we can only witness human behaviour. Choice is for camera crews.
An uninterrupted sequence of words and music. Sunday night at 10:15 on BBC Radio 3.
At 10 o'clock this evening on BBC Radio 3, we have performances by some of our new generation artists. Music by Foray, Carter and Brubeck. That's at 10, and it's followed at 10:45 by The Essay. This week's programmes are devoted to the one dynasty above all others which made its mark on Scottish medieval history, the Stuarts. Tonight, the crime writer Louise Welsh introduces Scotland's James II and the days when murder came by royal appointment. That's The Essay at 10:45 tonight. This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's now 9:15, and another chance for the next 45 minutes to hear a documentary first broadcast on Radio 3 last year. In I Come From There, Harriet Gilbert looks at the life and work of the celebrated and sometimes controversial Palestinian poet, the late Mahmoud Darwish. Darwish made his mark in the 1960s with poems critical of Israel. He was imprisoned and exiled, and he later wrote the Palestinian Declaration of Independence. But most of all, through his poetry, he gave voice to his people's history, and his importance was strongly felt right up to his funeral in 2008.
This thick and heavy layer of sadness descended on Palestine and specifically on Ramallah.
It's very hard to describe a personal loss. It's a very heavy feeling because his loss is very tangible.
It was extremely crowded from the place which is called Al-Muqata'a, where his coffin started to march to his grave. You talk about 5 to 6 kilometres. A whole thing full of people. You can see all generations. They are joining, crying.
The funeral of a poet doesn't often attract loud, crowded demonstrations of public grief, but Mahmoud Darwish was special. I knew him only through his writing and photographs, the baggy, sleep-deprived eyes behind glasses, the wide, amused, generous mouth. Even so, I still felt the world shrink when he died. And so how much more significant a loss it must have been for his fellow Palestinians, to whose sorrow, anger and hope his poems gave expression. A local hero then, but more. Around the world, Mahmoud Darwish was recognised as an extraordinary artist, as the poet Sarah Maguire, who's translated him, and first the conductor Daniel Barenboim in Milan, confirmed.
Mahmoud Darwish is not only probably Palestine's greatest poet, but I think Mahmoud Darwish is one of the great poets of the second half of the 20th century. His poetry has a combination of wonderfully evocative language, with also giving us the smell of his homeland.
I think when he died, he was one of the most important living poets in the world writing in any language, and he was very much welcomed by international figures like Wally Soyinka and Derek Walcott and Seamus Heaney. And there is something about Darwish's work that is timeless. I think the way that he took on the whole of the great tradition of Arabic poetry and reinvigorated it and infused it with this consciousness of his historical moment as a Palestinian will inevitably survive.
They would love to see me dead, to say, he belongs to us, he is ours. For 20 years I have heard their footsteps on the walls of the night. They open no door, yet they are here now. I see 3 of them, a poet, a killer, and a reader of books.
The opening of Darwish's poem, They Would Love to See Me Dead, from the 1980s. But if, with that astringent humour, he liked to suggest that his fellow Palestinians would rather shut him in a box than risk letting his poetry change too much, in fact, his public readings always drew vast crowds.
Whenever he read this poetry, the place, however large, would always be entirely full.
Raja Shahada is a Palestinian lawyer and writer who lives in Ramallah.
In places where it was possible in the Arab world, he sometimes read to an audience of 25,000 people. And certainly in Ramallah, when he did read, the hall would not only be full to capacity and people would be outside with their video link.
You get stadium rock. This is stadium poetry, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. And the amazing thing is that his poetry was not easy. And he didn't bow down to the audience. He insisted on the highest standards. It's quite amazing that he was able to be a popular poet and to be a poet of great, great standard and universality.
I think some of that double appeal lies in the coexistence in his poetry of an austere insistence on the truth and a softer, more sensual enjoyment of the physical. Wine, women, he was married twice, and as Sarah Maguire found, good clothes.
I was in Ramallah and I had gone there thinking that it was going to be really sunny, and so I'd taken all the wrong clothes with me, and the only way to keep warm was to borrow some clothes from some Palestinian friends, and so I looked really awful. And he's so grand. He was impeccably dressed and he smelt fantastic, and you know, and I'm a nobody as far as he was concerned, and he was very, very nice to me.
Khaled Khoub is director of the Cambridge University Arab Media Project and knew Darwish.
The first impression that you get is he is somehow a shy person. So unlike maybe what you would gather from his poetry, that he speaks about everything, he is daring, he would tackle this and that, he waits until you speak. And once he gets in the mood of talking about his poetry about something that he really likes, then he flows like a river. A second thing which is really kind of telling, when he writes, he has this ritual life. So he would wake up in the morning, take shower, and dresses up as if he is going to a meeting. And yet, this is in his flat, and he would sit at his desk and start writing poetry. And of course, with his really dear coffee that he just loved to make, and the smell of the coffee was just killing him.
إذا قيل لي ستموت هنا في المساء فماذا ستفعل فيما تبقى من الوقت.
If someone said to me, you're going to die this evening, so what will you do in the time that remains? I would say, I will look at my watch, drink a glass of juice, and crunch on an apple, and observe at length an ant that has found her day's supply of food. Then look at my watch. There is still time to shave and take a long shower. A thought will occur to me. One should look nice to write. So I'll wear something blue. I will sit until noon, alive, at my desk, not seeing a trace of colour in the words. White. White. White.
Bayad.
From one of Mahmoud Darwish's final poems, The Rest of a Life. But the paper in front of him was never, in fact, white and blank. He was born at a time, 1941, and more importantly, a place, a village in Western Galilee, that marked his page from the beginning. The translator and writer Peter Clark worked for many years for the British Council in the Middle East.
He came from the village of Birwa, a small village a few miles to the east of Acre. The family owned some land, but a lot of the work of the villagers were in quarries nearby. I went to the village of Birwa 10 years ago, and in 1948, the Israeli army cleared the village out. The villagers left, and the village was destroyed, and a number of settlements were put nearby there. And there was just a sort of copse there, undergrowth, no buildings at all, but we did come across an oil press, which was clearly too big to remove.
In 1948, with the creation of Israel, his family was driven from their village.
Yes. and they fled into Lebanon, and they were there for a short time in southern Lebanon, and then they returned to another village in Galilee, a little further to the east from Birwa, called Deir al-Assad, and he came back there and he went to school there.
The birth of Israel was bloody. On the 14th of May 1948, it was declared an independent state. The very next day, Arab armies attacked, and with war erupting around them, many civilian Palestinians fled abroad. The BBC's Middle East editor, Jeremy Bowen.
There's no question that many Palestinians left because they had no choice at all in the matter.
The circumstances in which Palestinians fled at the dawn of the Israeli state are hotly contested and continue to be fiercely argued over because of their implication for the problem of today's Palestinian refugees. Jeremy Bowen again.
All the circumstances surrounding the birth of Israel and what in 1948 Palestinians called the catastrophe, the Nakba, all that is enormously politically controversial and resonant right up to this very day. And the Israelis had something that they called Plan D. Some historians say that Plan D was a blueprint for ethnic cleansing, and others say it was simply a plan to hold land for military reasons. And there's a celebrated and, in a way, infamous and controversial Israeli historian, Benny Morris, who's looked at this probably more than anybody else. And he's someone who says Plan D was not a political blueprint for the expulsion of Palestine's Arabs. It was governed by military considerations. But this is the key point that he makes, and I would very much agree with it. Given the nature of the war and the admixture of populations, securing the interior of the Jewish state, in practice, he says, meant the depopulation and destruction of the villages. So, I mean, whichever way you want to look at it, did Israel intend to raise the villages simply to get rid of the Arabs, or did they do it to hold the land, and the consequence was that they got rid of the Arabs? Whatever happened, the Palestinian Arabs weren't there anymore in large areas of the territory that became Israel in 1948.
Because Mahmoud Darwish's family did return, although their actual home village was gone, Darwish grew up with both Arabic and Hebrew cultural influences. The poet Ruth Padel has written about Darwish.
Early on, he was taught to read by his grandfather, and that would have been in Arabic, but the first poems he heard were in Hebrew. They were from a singer who was on the run from the Israeli army. And so he was fluent in Hebrew when he was at school. And when he read foreign poets like Lorca, you know, who's a very important poet for him, you know, a Spanish poet, but he read it in Hebrew. And I think that's wonderful. There is this sense that for him, Hebrew, the language of the occupier, he respected it. It is very, of course, close to Arabic. And he was very influenced by Hebrew writing, from the Torah to Yehuda Amichai. When he was 8, he recited a poem at his school's annual celebration of Israel's birth. And that was when he realized the power that poetry can have. And he remembered later that the poem was a cry from an Arab boy to a Jewish boy. You can play in the sun as you please. You have your toys. I can't. Why can't we play together? And the military governor summoned him and said, if you go on writing poems like that, he was saying this to a little boy of 8, I'll stop your father working in the quarry. And so what message does that send to a bright boy? It sends the message, poetry is more powerful than anything.
If Hebrew and Jewish Israeli culture generally were important to Darwish, something he always recognised, how important was and is he to Jewish Israelis? The journalist Avirama Golan of Haaretz newspaper in Tel Aviv.
If you ask professionals, that is to say, if you ask poets, if you ask writers, if you ask critics, everybody knows that Mahmoud Darwish is one of the greatest, not only here, not only in the Middle East, but in the world. And his last book that was translated to Hebrew sold so well that after 3 weeks, it was sold out. And he is very much recognised.
But only up to a point. As Avirama Golan told me, in March 2000, a proposal was made that Darwish's poetry be put onto the Israeli national curriculum.
Of course, those two poems were not political at all. But the right-wing politicians in Israel started to shout that it is out of the question that Darwish poems would be taught in school, etc., etc. And the whole thing was a catastrophe, of course, and it ended with quarrels in the parliament and nothing came out of it.
The Jewish-Israeli influences on the young Darwish were political too. Avirama Golan interviewed one of his old teachers, the communist Nima Morcus, and says that Darwish often talked of him.
Instead, Nima Morcus gave me my first colour box, and he taught me everything I had to know about colours and about great painters of the world, and he opened my mind and opened my eyes to understand justice. So he became a communist himself. He was sent, Mahmoud Darwish was sent by the Communist Party to Moscow, to University of Moscow, as did most of the elite in Haifa and in Acre at the time. Most of them became members of the Communist Party.
Peter Clark.
Some of the early poetry has almost Marxist terminology in it, comrades, the struggle, and things like that. But this fitted in with this sense of anger and dignity that I think there are in these early poems. I think sometimes they're very strong and like verbal hand grenades.
Well, maybe you could talk in particular about one of those earlier poems, Identity Card.
Yes. It's widely known throughout the Arab world. It's part of the mental furniture of every Arab who's been to school, because it's very specifically Palestinian, but he's a Palestinian who's also an Arab. And so it helps Arabs throughout the Arab world and in the Arab diaspora to identify with Palestine.
سجل أنا عربي ورقم بطاقتي 50,000 وأطفالي 8 وتاسعهم سيأتي بعد صيف.
Write down. I am an Arab, and my identity card number is 50,000. I have 8 children, and the 9th will come after a summer.
Will you be angry?
Write down. I am an Arab, employed with fellow workers at a quarry. I have 8 children. I get them bread, garments, and books from the rocks. I do not supplicate charity at your doors, nor do I belittle myself at the footsteps of your chamber.
So will you be angry?
Write down, I am an Arab. I have a name without a title, patient in a country where people are enraged. My roots were entrenched before the birth of time, and before the opening of the eras, before the pines and the olive trees, and before the grass grew. My father descends from the family of the plough, not from a privileged class. And my grandfather was a farmer, neither well-bred nor well-born, teaches me the pride of the sun before teaching me how to read. And my house is like a watchman's hut made of branches and cane. Are you satisfied with my status? I have a name without a title. Write down, I am an Arab. You have stolen the orchards of my ancestors and the land which I cultivated along with my children, and you left nothing for us except for these rocks. So will the state take them, as it has been said? Therefore, write down on the top of the first page, I do not hate people, nor do I encroach. But if I become hungry, the usurper's flesh will be my food. Beware, beware of my hunger and my anger.
حذاري من جوعي ومن غضبي.
Identity Card from 1964. But even if life in Israel was hard and confrontational, for Darwish, exile initially in Moscow wasn't much of an improvement. Peter Clark again.
This was 20 years before the fall of the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union had favoured Palestinians and other radical Arabs, and so he went there. But he didn't stay long. I don't know if he was fed up there. I can certainly see that it was a particularly painful exile to be in Moscow. But after that, he was in different parts of the Arab world. For a while in the 70s and early 80s, he was in Beirut. And when the PLO, Palestine Liberation Organization, was thrown out of Beirut in 1985, he left and was in Tunisia for a few years.
I think being outside helps you see it in a different way.
Ruth Padel.
It's like moving a fulcrum or moving to another position in the solar system helps you see Earth in a different way. When you come back to it, you see it newly. And I think probably Darwish did that by going outside and then going back. What enriched him so much from the start by learning Hebrew, by knowing Hebrew and the Hebrew poets, and going away, being in other places, and then coming back, always reading poetry, of course, is this sense of containing with everything you say, every word that you use, the perspective of the other as well as the self.
One day we'll become what we want. The journey hasn't begun, and the path hasn't ended. The wise haven't reached their exile, nor the exiles their wisdom. The only flower we know is the red anemone. Come, let's go towards the highest mural. The land of my poem is green and high. God's words at dawn are the land of my poem. And I'm the far away. Far away.
From one of Darwish's best-known longer poems, Mural. While in exile, Beirut to be exact, Darwish became a member of the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, Aviram HaGolan.
I think that we have to draw a line between Mahmoud Darwish, the poet, and Mahmoud Darwish, the politician. And he was a politician. He was very much involved in politics. He was a member of the PLO. It took sides. You have to draw a line between the political poetry, which is a great poetry, and the political poetry, which is a kind of a pamphlet. And he has some poems that, unfortunately, are more like a pamphlet.
Darwish also wrote directly political prose, notably some important speeches for the PLO leader Yasser Arafat. Despite the fact that his own dream for Israel, that it could become a land in which Arabs, Jews and others could live with equality, wasn't identical to the PLO's, he scripted Arafat's well-known speech to the UN about carrying an olive branch, but also a gun. Raja Shahada and first Khaled Khoub.
He was very passionate when it comes to political activism. And in the 70s, he became very close to Yasser Arafat. I think the very famous speech that he wrote was the speech that Arafat himself delivered at the United Nations in New York, 1974.
And he was also one of the authors of the Declaration of Independence in 1988 when the PLO accepted the compromise of a Palestinian state alongside Israel and wrote a beautiful Declaration of Independence, which remains mere words because we don't have independence, but he was part of the PLO thinking and the PLO development.
He was at one point a member of the PLO, the Executive Committee, which is the high-ranking leadership of the Palestinian Liberation Organization. His political, if you like, orientation or positions were sometimes controversial because for somebody like him, he wanted Palestine, not for the Palestinians. He never been or even felt as a nationalist in the very narrow sense of the word. He felt he wanted Palestine as open air, open land, open territory. Everybody lives there. So he has this kind of utopian image, the poetic image about Palestine.
The PLO wasn't always non-violent. Both the USA and Israel have considered it a terrorist organisation, and within Israel and outside it's been linked to many deaths, including, perhaps most notoriously, the massacre at the 1972 Munich Olympics of Israeli athletes. So where did Darwish stand on violent action? Peter Clark.
The PLO, by the 80s and 90s, when Darwish was fairly well involved, it was seen as the legitimate body representing the Palestinian people, and this was recognised by something like 100 countries in the world. But the PLO, until it entered into negotiations with Israel, was seen as a terrorist organisation, and by some elements, even after that. Darwish himself was never involved in military action, and his contribution was as a spokesman of the Palestinian people. He was also active in one branch of the PLO, which was the Palestinian Research Department, based initially in Beirut, and he worked there with them. So he was a scholar and a poet, not at all involved on the military side.
Whatever you make of that distinction, when the PLO itself did begin to negotiate with Israel and arrived at the famous Oslo Accords, for Darwish, it was the end of his hope for a one-state solution.
When Oslo Agreement in 1993-94 was signed up by the Palestinians and the Israelis, basically divided the land. One quarter to the Palestinians and three quarters to the Israelis. So he felt that poetic image in his mind, you know, that kind of maybe mixing everybody, regardless of their religion, nationality, origin, and having this kind of utopia kind of destroyed in his mind.
For many, though, the Oslo Accords felt like a real breakthrough. Jeremy Bowen.
In 1993, after this Oslo process, there was this historic handshake on the White House lawn under the smiling face of the young President Clinton on a historic table on a sunny day. And from the Israeli side, there was the Prime Minister, Yitzhak Rabin. There was the Foreign Minister, Shimon Peres. And on the Palestinian side, there was Yasser Arafat, the face of Palestinian nationalism, the greatest enemy most Israelis believed they could ever have. And they shook hands. They all shook hands. And it was a time of real hope.
The impact of the Oslo Accords on Darwish personally was enormous. Raja Shahada and first Khaled Khoub.
He decided, first of all, to resign from the PLO, and he did not believe in the practicality and maybe the real implementation of the Oslo Agreement, again, because of this kind of imposed division.
He was, I think, pained by the compromise that the PLO had made in the Oslo Accords. And I think he, in a sense, got beyond nationalism, and as he was feeling his time was running out, he made the decision when it was possible to return to Ramallah to do so.
Ramallah, 1995, a strange homecoming. For Darwish, in many ways, it felt like another kind of exile. But pouring from open windows around the town, he'd have heard his poetry set to music and sung by the popular Lebanese star Marcel Khalifa.
I think it was just very painful, and I think being in Ramallah is painful.
Sarah Maguire, who herself has spent some time in Ramallah under siege.
Just the humiliation and the poverty and the chaos and the potholed streets and the intermittent electricity and the terrible phone lines and, you know, all of these kind of things, given that for a lot of his adult life he'd lived in Beirut and Tunis and for a long time in Paris, where, you know, he was treated like a god. And I think to come back to Ramallah was actually very painful for him. But also he felt an enormous sense of solidarity with the Palestinians, with what they were going through. So he knew that he needed to be there for himself and for them. And he clearly wouldn't have written a state of siege if he hadn't been there.
هنا عند منحدرات التلال أمام الغروب وفوهة الوقت.
Here, at the mercy of time, on these foothills at sunset, near ripped-up orchards stripped of their shadows, we do what prisoners do. We do what the unemployed do. We cultivate hope. In a land preparing for its dawn, we grew stupid once we stared victory straight in the face. There is no night in our long nights starred by explosions. Our enemies stay up all night. Our enemies light up the lights in the dark pit of our caves. Here, after the poetry of Job, there's no one to wait for. Here, I is annihilated. Here, Adam remembers the clay from which he was formed. This siege will endure till we can teach our enemies odes of our Canaanite poetry. Late morning, the sky is like lead. At night it bursts into flames. And our hearts are like roses trained on a fence.
بعد أشعار أيوب لم ننتظر أحدا. في الحصار تكون الحياة هي الوقت.
Here, under siege, life serves time. A time between remembering its beginning and forgetting its end.
Life, life lived to the full or a life thrown away, still harbours the neighbouring stars, still gathers the timeless migrating clouds. But here, life begs the question, how can we bring it back to life?
Being back among his people did nothing to lessen perhaps his greatest struggle as an artist, the long-standing tension between the political simplicity some readers wanted from his work and the duty he himself felt he owed his poetry sometimes came near to breaking point, as is clear from poems like Assassination, written just a couple of years before he died, Khaled Roub.
He grew, I would say, kind of really deeply irritated by this labelling, that first of all, you are the poet of resistance. And the poet of resistance in that kind of reduced sense, not in the broader sense that he wanted to be. Number two is you are the voice of Palestine. So he feels all these kind of things and the expectation, the high expectation that if we are going to hear you reading, so we would expect Palestine is there, the Palestinian issue, all these kind of nationalistic aspirations and all our agenda, you know, for a struggle with Israel and occupiers. And he kept affirming and reaffirming that, judge me on the merits of my poetry. I am a poet. And even my Palestinian dimension, my longing for the liberation of Palestine, comes because I am a poet.
The critics kill me sometimes. They want a particular poem, a particular metaphor. And if I stray up a side road, they say he has betrayed the road. And if I find eloquence in grass, they say he has abandoned the steadfastness of the holm oak. And if I see the rose in spring as yellow, they ask, where is the blood of the homeland in its petals? And if I write, it is the butterfly my youngest sister at the garden door, they stir the meaning with a soup spoon. And if I whisper, a mother is a mother, when she loses her child, she withers and dries up like a stick. They say, she trills with joy and dances at his funeral, for his funeral is his wedding. And if I look up at the sky to see the unseen, they say poetry has strayed far from its objectives. The critics kill me sometimes, and I escape from their reading and thank them for their misunderstanding, then search for my new poem.
Darwish did continue to find new poems, ones that he wanted to write. Sarah Maguire.
In the late 90s, he published a book of love poems, effectively. And, of course, within these poems, there are images of exile and displacement and confusion. And one can read these very intimate love poems through a political lens, if you like. That's possible to do with any good love poem, of course. But there was this tension, I think, with his audience. But he was determined, and I think quite rightly determined, to be a poet. And in order to be a good poet, you have to be true to your own impulses. And this was something that Bertolt Brecht struggled with during his time of exile from Nazi Germany, when he really struggled with the idea of being a lyric poet. And one of the things that really threw him was that he came across Wordsworth's Lucy poems. And he was overwhelmed by them, their beauty and their tenderness. And he didn't like that initially, being Brecht. But then he realised that the whole thing about lyric poetry is, in times of extraordinary political upheaval, the right to joy is an enormously important political act. That is absolutely a stand against fascism and terrorism and all of those awful things that want to overwhelm one. So Darwish's insistence on being a lyric poet and writing love poems and publishing this book when Palestinians were very thrown by it, I think is in itself a political act and a very brave act.
بكأس الشراب المرصع باللازوردي انتظرها على بركة الماء حول المساء وزهر الكولونيا انتظرها.
With a goblet fashioned from lapis lazuli, wait for her. At dusk in a grove of orange trees in bloom, wait for her. With the patience of a horse trained in the mountains, wait for her.
with the exquisite taste and breeding of a prince. Wait for her. With 7 cushions stuffed with clouds, wait for her. With skeins of fragrant incense wafting through your rooms, wait for her. With the masculine scent of sandalwood and leather, wait for her.
The thing that's outstanding about it is that it is so exquisitely sensual. And it's teaching men a lesson about how they should approach women.
If she is late in arriving, have patience. Then wait for her. If she arrives early, she will find you already waiting. Then wait for her. Do not startle the birds resting on her hair. And wait for her. Wait for her until she opens like a garden coming full into bloom. And wait for her. Wait for her to breathe easy in this weather so strange to her heart. And wait for her. Wait for her to loosen her garments silk by silk. And wait for her. Take her onto the balcony when the full moon is drowning in mist. Wait for her. لترى قمرا غارقا في الحليب انتظرها
وقدم لها الماء قبل النبيذ. And it covers every sense. It's got smells, it's got textures, it's got colours, it's got everything that would delight you.
Wait for her offering water before wine. Never glance at the twin white doves asleep on her breast. And wait for her. Brush her hand gently as she sets down her cup upon marble, as though you were gathering the dew from her skin. And wait for her.
And running through it is this little refrain, wait for her. And that is just so erotic.
Speak to her as if you were a flute tuning a violin. Speak to her as if you both know what tomorrow will bring. And wait for her. Polish the night sky for her, star after star. And wait for her. Wait for her until at last the night tells you its secret. No one else exists in the world but you two lovers. Then take her softly to the death you both so desire. And wait for her.
I think that's one of the most outstanding love poems by a man poet to a woman that I have ever read.
From Darwish's Lesson from the Kama Sutra, whose erotic tension in some ways embodies the overall attraction of Darwish's poetry, the way it achieves its poise, not through relaxation, but restraint, passion checked by intelligence, anger held back by empathy, sorrow contained by a sense of the ridiculous. As elusive as he was as a person, these attributes are clear from his writing, even in translation. For Arabic speakers, Darwish's poetry offers even more. Raja Shahada.
He advanced the poetic language and brought in imagery that he innovated that wasn't there before. And the Arabic language lends itself to making connections that would sound very odd in English. And Arabic is a language for poetry. It's just so evocative as a language. It has so many different sounds. Some are very deep sounds, guttural sounds, and some are very aspirated sounds. وأنت تعد فطورك فكر بغيرك لا تنس قوت الحمام
وأنت تخوض حروبك فكر بغيرك. When I read him, I hear the voice of somebody who is talking out of a land and a people and making images that I really respond to.
Ruth Padel.
I mean, there are Mediterranean images, if you like. The olive tree, the dove, the gazelle, the stone, and then the sort of the bullet in among all that.
Of course, always the bullet. And he couldn't ever detach himself entirely from politics. In the very last year of his life, he stepped forward publicly to denounce the violence between Fatah and Hamas, the two main Palestinian political parties, accusing them of destroying themselves and, I quote, committing suicide on the streets. But did anyone listen, I asked Raja Shahada.
Oh, well, absolutely, because this is how people feel, that we're falling in the trap that Israel has been hoping that we'll fall in all this time. And his words were heard and accepted, but of course it didn't have a political impact. It didn't resolve anything. But he was so aware that he started off thinking that poetry would have real impact, and then realized that poetry has impact, but it doesn't move anybody. It doesn't make any political change.
I think one of the most useful comparisons is with Seamus Heaney. Darwish was born under the British Mandate in Palestine, and he saw his village taken from his family. Heaney grew up under the Troubles, and in the 1980s, when there were bombs and killings throughout Northern Ireland, and he was a young man, he was facing this question of how do you write poems? Is there any point of writing poems in a situation like this, when real people are dying and there is cruelty and inequality and injustice? And the answer is, yes, poetry can be a witness. I mean, that's important, the witness of poetry, as Milos has said. And Milos is perhaps another very good parallel. You cannot just write and say, this is bad. You've got to make a good original poem that is